This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Maria Bamford, has a style of comedy that can almost make you uncomfortable because so much of it is about really serious problems she has. OCD, bipolar disorder, and suicidal thoughts. She's been hospitalized several times. But her performances are seriously funny. She's done some really odd web shows. The oddest is probably her program, The Special Special Special, which was her doing her act in her living room with her parents on the couch as her only audience. In addition to stand-up, she's done a lot of animated voiceover work. And you may have seen her on the new Netflix season of Arrested Development. Now she has a new CD called Ask Me About My New God that also comes with a DVD of her two Comedy Central specials. Terry spoke with Maria Bamford earlier this month.
Maria Bamford, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show. I want to play something that's from earlier work that you did. And
okay.
This is from a 2007 show that's actually on DVD along with your CD. And this is your anxiety song. It's called My Anxiety Song. So let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
Well, this is my anxiety song. If I keep the kitchen floor clean, no one will die. As long as I clench my fists at odd intervals, then the darkness within me won't force me to do anything inappropriately violent or sexual at dinner parties. Woof! As long as I keep humming a tune, I won't turn gay. It can't get you if you're singing a song. Yeah!
That's Maria Bamford. I really love that. How many of those anxieties are actually yours? How many of those compulsive behaviors?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, no, those are mine. When I was about 9 years old, I stopped being able to sleep at night because I had fear that I was going to kill my parents, act out violently in some sort of taboo way. And it's even hard for me to say now, act out sexually towards somebody. And so wanted to isolate so that I would not be around people at all and would stay up all night making sure that I just wouldn't fall asleep and somehow lose control and fearing I was going to do those things. And just to explain that that is a type of obsessive compulsive disorder, what it is, it's the equivalent of, you know, washing your hands thinking that you're going to be dirty or that you're somehow dirty, but it's with thoughts. So as soon as you try to not think of the thought pops up again. So because most of us have weird thoughts floating through our heads every once in a while. I know there's I heard a comedian once say, you know, my dog looks kind of sexy today. You know, like things where it's like, oh, that's wrong. But usually nobody thinks twice about that. You just kind of like go, oh, that's weird. And then you pass it. But if you are an anxious person and somehow on high alert, you think, oh, I just thought my dog looked sexy. Well, that must be, you know, I am somehow a dangerous person who, you know, it's sort of this spiraling effect. And I'm of course, not any sort of expert or physician, but I did get help for it. I went to an OCD specialist. And within 2 weeks, I was 35 when I went, it was gone. Something that had plagued me for my entire life was gone.
How did that happen?
They did this technique called flooding, where you, the particular one was, I recorded, you know, my worst fear of what's going to happen. You know, I am chopping my friends and family up into chunks and bits. And I do a joke about it. I don't know. It sounds terrifying now with the way I say it, but I do a joke about it saying, like, the therapist is the OCD therapist. So have you ever not wanted to go to a religious institution because you worried you'd lose control, run up on the altar, take a crap, and yell, I am a promise keeper? No. Have you ever not wanted to go to SeaWorld because you're worried if you're left alone with the baby starfish, you'd try to kiss its poop hole? Oh, God, that sounds familiar, but I'm not placing it.
Have you ever not wanted to spend time with friends or family because you were you'd chop them up into chunks and bits and have sex with the chunks and bits and put the chunks and bits on a Cobb salad and feed it to your parents? All the time. God. Aren't you even listening? Anyways, yeah, I mean, it's like those are the thoughts. You know, people have some weird thoughts. And but flooding, what they do is you have the read out loud in the present tense of your worst fear happening. You just listen to it over and over and over again. And, you know, it really limited my life. I did not spend a lot of time with people because I was felt afraid. And stand-up was very good for that because I you can spend time with people, but they're safe and you're amplified and lit. And it's a very structured environment. So but now I am freed by the miracles of psychology and science and all that stuff. I mean, if there is a science, we don't know if there is a science, but if there is.
So, you know, maybe it's a sign of my own self-absorption, but my unwanted obsessive thoughts tend to be about things that are going to happen to me as opposed to dangerous things I'm going to do to other people.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everybody has their own special, snowflake thumbprint anxiety. What is yours? Do you feel comfortable sharing? You don't have to share.
I probably not, but you know, no. I always worry about things that are gonna, you know, I've got by getting hurt, about, you know, suffering and pain and things like that. I worry about hurting people's feelings. I don't worry about physically doing harm to them because I just don't feel like I'd even have that in me. Like that's not an, it's like not an, of all the bad impulses I have, that particular thing isn't one of them.
Well, that is the weirdest thing. Like they said, or one of the things the physician I went to said, that people who have any type of OCD are the people who are least likely to have any violent tendencies or any predatorial tendencies or any, you know, like the person who's washing their hands and 18 times a day or 1800 times a day is the person least likely to not be clean. You know, like they're going to be some clean people, despite the fact that that's all they worry about is that they're somehow filthy.
You did a comedy special that was just web only that you called The Special, Special, Special. And I've never seen anything like it. Your parents make an appearance in this. So the setup is, it's shot in your living room. The only people in the audience are your parents who are seated on a couch. Your name is up in lights on the wall. Lights like in those kind of 40-watt bulbs that you use in a lamp or something. and there's a pianist there, Wayne Fetterman. He's at the piano like playing intros. And you even have a warm-up comic played by Jackie Cation. And so I want to play the opening to The Special, Special, Special. And it opens, as a lot of like HBO comedy specials do, with, you know, the comic talking backstage behind the scenes about what the special is and why they're doing it. So first we're going to hear that, you know, fake interview. and we'll hear the setup to the show. Here we go.
The reason I decided to do the special here was because it is free to perform in your own home.
We are at the Maria Bamford Special. Are you guys psyched? Are we all psyched? Yeah.
I've done television shows. I've been in a few seconds of certain movies. But the people I'm really creating things for are Joel and Marilyn Bamford, my parents. I do know their names, Joel and Marilyn Bamford.
It's Maria Bamford, performing live in her own living room in Eagle Rock, California. It's The Special, Special, Special. Tonight's only audience members, Maria's parents.
It's going to be a special, special, special.
All right, and we're ready. Let's hear you laugh. Let's hear you laugh. Hi. Yay! And the clapping, that's right. We're ready to begin. Wayne, let's get some music going. Get Maria out here. You know her from birth. You've known her for a long time, since the very beginning. Let's have a big round of applause. A big Eagle Rock welcome for Maria Bamford.
Jackie Cation. Wayne Fetterman.
Yeah.
thanks so much for coming, Mom and Dad.
That is really so amazing. What gave you the idea of doing a comedy special in your living room for your parents and recording it?
Well, I feel embarrassed to say this, but it was an act of slight laziness where I was like, you know, I hadn't been feeling well the year prior, you know, and I didn't want to do a big crowd. Like, crowds kind of, it's funny because the bigger the crowds get, the more nervous I get. I actually am very comfortable with a half filled room of people who are slightly disinterested and are irritated at a Barnes & Noble. So, I am more comfortable with that. And my parents are so supportive. They are also extremely inexpensive as talent. And it is true that the people who it makes me feel the best when they laugh are my family and friends. I mean, when they laugh, I feel great.
So was the laughter fake or was it real?
No, I think it was. I mean, I'm sure sometimes they're just kind of staring and being supportive. I can't imagine that there isn't some aspect of where they're just losing themselves in the idea that their daughter is doing something and they're just proud that she's functioning relatively well. And I think, yeah, I don't know. You'd have to ask them what part of it is. But I know my mom has gotten irritated about certain because sometimes my mom just writes the joke herself. She couldn't find me in the house once, and an object at rest stays at rest. I'm in a corner curled with my bristles to the outside. And she called my sister in a panic and said, Maria has disappeared, and I'm worried she's killed herself, and I have a hair appointment in town. Which, I mean, that is so hilarious. And, you know, you wouldn't dredge the shallows. She got very upset that I was going to say that. But then once she heard it a couple times live and people laughed, she was fine with it. Or she just says, oh, I never said that.
Did she really say that? Did she really say to your sister,
yes.
I'm afraid your sister's killed herself and I have a hair
yes.
appointment?
Yes.
And what did your sister say?
My sister just told me. she left it on the voicemail, so she didn't have a chance to respond except to say, why don't you check the bed, Mom? Check the bed. She's probably in there.
When did you start doing voices, and what were the first voices that you did?
I think I mimicked some commercials, and I don't actually do very many voices. I only do about 6 or 7. Some are just versions of higher or lower versions of others. So, but I think it also in stand-up it helped because my own voice, some have said, is high, irritating, childlike. And so if you can change your voice, it did grab people's attention.
You've done voiceover work for cartoons, right? Have you done a lot of different
yes.
characters?
Yes. I'm on Adventure Time, which is a great series on the Cartoon Network. It's a beautiful show, just so weird and creative. And then I've done Word Girl on PBS, which is coming back. They're going to have Word Girl, which is a girl superhero who fights off villains with the power of vocabulary.
Are you Word Girl?
I am not Word Girl. That is played by someone else, but I am play her mother.
Do you use your mother's voice?
No. I use a basic, just a proud mother voice who's just proud and excited and wants everyone to be happy.
I love that voice that you do because it's in some ways you would describe it as a very nondescript voice, but it's not. Do you know what I mean? It's
yes.
It's like the essence of a certain mainstream middle American voice.
Yeah. I think I've felt like a bit of a weirdo sometimes, so that sometimes that voice it helps. You know, as sort of a counterpoint to what, I worked as a secretary for a long time, so I would have, sometimes would have a female boss who acts like they're your friend, but hey, I'm having a party at my house this week, and I really want you to come and meet some really cute, really available men at the door. Park their cars, take their coats, and speak only when spoken to. Because I see us as partners as equal, even though I earn, what is it, 850% more than you do, and you spend 12 hours a day here stuck in this office while I drive aimlessly around the city looking for caves and tunnels from where I can call you with my cell phone.
I'm trying to imagine you as somebody's secretary.
Oh, yes. No, I was very quiet. I was not a...
Were you performing at the time?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm very passive-aggressive, which is... So it was always very quiet at work and then talk about work outside of work. Yeah.
Yep. One of the things that you did when you were young is you went to Dale Carnegie classes, self-improvement
yes.
classes. What was his famous book, How to Win Friends and Influence People?
Influence People. I was extremely depressed, and my dad, I was having trouble with falling asleep because I was staying up all night.
Trying to prevent yourself from doing bad things?
Bad things, and had developed sort of an eating disorder in order to, I think, deal with my brain chemistry. I would, you know, binge on huge amounts of food and then try to starve. And I think that, is, you know, you develop all these sort of addictions to try to manage, or I feel like is part of what happened. And so I was sleeping all day at schools. My dad took me to the Dale Carnegie 18-week course at the Duluth Public Library that's shaped like an oar boat in the basement. And we went with many salespeople and business people of the city, and we learned the four C's, don't criticize, condemn, or complain, compliment. The sweetest sound of a person's ear is the sound of their own name, Terry, and that you act enthusiastic, and you will be enthusiastic. And it was really a cognitive behavioral program. Like, it helped me enormously at the time.
Did you do the things I suggested, like repeat somebody's name a lot when you were talking
to
them?
I did it all the time. I did it my entire senior year. And in that way, I think that's how I got my first boyfriend. I won the Winter Frolic Queen crown. I think genuinely because I started doing all these weird techniques and because everyone was in high school, I think nobody picked up on the BS factor of it. And I think it was sincere. You know, I was so desperately sincere. I tried to use the same tactics when I went to school out east, and it did not go over at all. I remember my roommates, I was going to Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and they were from New York, and they're like, why do you keep saying our name? Like, why? They were just totally on to me immediately, and they were completely weirded out by the whole thing.
So then what if you couldn't use the Dale Carnegie techniques anymore? What did you do to try to more comfortably relate to people?
Well, I fell into a deep depression.
That always helps.
That helps. And then I did start doing stand-up around that time and got involved in improv and theater. And
well, tell me more about how you started doing stand-up.
They had a talent show, and I'd always done run for office in grade school, high school, because it involved doing a speech. And I just loved every time I got to do a speech. And I think there is something about I love structured social environments, you know, where there's rituals and, you know, I love a support group, you know, where everyone's timed in how long they can talk. Like, ugh, give me 3 minutes and and 1 minute for wrap up and I feel comfortable. So I think I got involved in that. And so then when the opportunity came up to do a talent show, I was like, oh, I'll just do a funny speech. And then they said, oh, that's stand-up. And I was like, okay. Well, then I guess that's what I'm going to show up for, and began doing that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Maria Bamford. She has a new comedy CD, which is called Ask Me About My New God. I want to play another track from the new CD, and this is called Joy Whack-A-Mole. And it's something your family used to do, you've defined as this game.
Yes.
So why don't we hear this this bit from your act, and then we'll talk about it.
This is a little game you can play with your friends and family. I hope you do if you don't already play it.
leave you with it. It is a, my family would call it joy whack-a-mole. What happens is that somebody brings up something that they're really happy about, and then the other person tries to slam it down. Playing with my dad, and I was like, "Dad, check out this new top. Oh, it's very nice. Yeah, guess how much? Oh, I don't know, $50. No, $5. Jeez, that's a good deal. Yeah, you got that right. It's like $5. How do they do it? Oh, I was reading about that. Slavery. Manufacturing out of these countries, there's no labor laws, human rights violations, no environmental protection, and then they pass that savings on to you. It's a pretty sweet coat, though, Dad. It kind of skims the profile. My mom is truly the king of this game, though. She's very good. Mom, Amy hit her baby. Oh, that is great news, honey. I mean, it's not the greatest news for the 600,000 kids in foster care in this country, but she wants a fresh one, huh? Jeez. Everybody wants one that looks like them. It's so selfish. I'm doing a show tonight. Oh. Sweetie, I have a joke for you. A friend of mine is just a hoot. She said you could use it. And coincidentally, she was in foster care. She had been airlifted out of the Sudan in the late 90s because she had been bearmed and belegged by the Janjaweed, the horseback militia. Anywho, she'd love to do stand-up. She's hilarious, but she can't. And it's really a hospice situation, just a matter of time, but the priest comes in and he asks her, would you like us to light a candle for you in the chapel? Well, she says, sassy as you please, teletyping through her eyelids, well, how many candles you got? Because so many horrible things have happened to her and keep happening. Sweetie, have a good show tonight. What you do is so important.
That's Maria Bamford from her new CD, Ask Me About My New God. Do you play Joy Whack-A-Mole with yourself every time something good happens?
Sure.
Undermine
it.
Yeah.
Oh, Maria, you're on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You're no longer underdog status, so people are going to hate you. Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's a negative to every positive. Now I'm a winner, Terry. You've made it official. I'm a winner.
I've conferred that status.
Yes.
As only I can.
Yes.
Maria Bamford, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been such an honor and a pleasure. I feel so excited. Thank you.
Maria Bamford spoke with Terry Gross earlier this month. Bamford's new comedy album, which comes with a DVD of her Comedy Central specials, is called Ask Me About My New God. You'll find a link to her web series, The Maria Bamford Show, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Orson Welles, who died in 1985, was known as one of America's greatest filmmakers and was legendary for his ability to talk. For years, there were rumors that filmmaker Henry Jaglom had taped hours and hours of their conversations, but that the tapes had been lost. They weren't. And now, the transcripts have been released in the new book, My Lunches with Orson, edited and introduced by Peter Biskind. Our critic at large, John Powers, has read the book and says that it's both a treat and a revealing glimpse of a man whose brilliance included a knack for self-mythologizing.
If you ask me to name my favorite movie scene, I choose the one in Citizen Kane, when newspaper owner Charles Foster Kane steals his rival's best reporters, then throws a party in his own honor. As musicians literally sing his praises, we watch Kane dance with chorus girls, wearing a look of radiant delight. It's a moment bursting with promise and cockiness and joie de vivre, made all the more exuberant because Kane's pleasure is so obviously shared by Welles himself. Only 25, but already famous from Broadway and radio, Wells has the air of a man who knows he's making a movie that would one day be named the greatest of all time. Now, if you've seen Citizen Kane, you know that things don't turn out so well for Kane. The same proved true for Wells, who went on to have one of the great wounded careers in modern art. Although he made other major films, from The Magnificent Ambersons to Chimes at Midnight, Wells spent decades struggling to get money, starting unfinished projects, and falling into sloppiness. He was eventually reduced to doing commercials for supermarket wine and being the greatest talk show guest ever. That's where we find him in My Lunches with Orson, a new book that collects and edits the table talk between Wells and his friend, filmmaker Henry Jaglom. In the early 1980s, the two regularly lunched together at the Beverly Hills restaurant Ma Maison, and Jaglom taped their conversations, if conversation is the term. You see, Wells was an inveterate monologuist, so Jaglom winds up being basically a rhinoceros bird, carried along by this whopping beast of a man. If you love old movies, My Lunches with Orson is like being handed a big tin of macadamia nuts. You just keep devouring it. Wells talks about everything from the secret side of Katharine Hepburn, she talked dirty and was hot to trot, to how The Godfather is, quote, the glorification of a bunch of bums who never existed, unquote. He knows this because he used to bed the same showgirls real gangsters did. Although a lifelong man of the left, Wells says the right-wingers in Hollywood were much nicer people, especially John Wayne, who was a prince. As I read, I found myself calling up YouTube clips of Wells just to hear that extraordinary voice, so resonant and filled with life. Here, for instance, Charles Foster Kane replies to his financial trustee, who objects to his newspaper's editorial policies.
Charles, I think I should remind you of a fact that you seem to have forgotten.
Yes.
That you are yourself one of the largest individual stockholders in the public transit company.
The trouble is you don't realize you're talking to two people. As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of public transit preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's
on the other hand, I am the publisher of The Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests.
Wells shared Kane's knack for self-dramatization and self-commentary, and My Lunches with Orson is charged with the drama of grand failure. He's constantly complaining about how badly the film world is treating him. Yet at one point, a woman from HBO is at their table saying she'd like to work with him, and he's so insulting, you see why he struggled to raise money. Underlying the insult is Wells' know-it-all vainglory. He's constantly lecturing Jaglom. And the habitual self-destructiveness of a bon vivant who loses his badly needed job as pitchman for Paul Masson by going on a talk show and saying he lost weight by giving up wine. At some level, Wells surely grasped his failings, or sins, as he preferred to call them. After all, his enduring theme was the glory and tragedy of the grandiose self, be it Cain, Harry Lime, or Falstaff in his Shakespeare film Chimes at Midnight. And being a natural showman, he didn't merely live the tragedy of the thwarted artist, he performed it. He helped set the template for artists from Norman Mailer to Lena Dunham, whose art keeps blurring the line between the self and the public persona. One great virtue of My Lunches with Orson is that it sends you back to Wells' own work, which naturally remains far more eloquent than these conversations. At the end of Touch of Evil, Marlene Dietrich offers an assessment of Wells' character, the magnificently corrupt lawman Hank Quinlan. He was some kind of a man, she says. And judging from this book, I suspect the Grand Orson would have passed the same verdict on himself.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the new book, My Lunches with Orson. Coming up, David Gilbert talks about his new novel, And Sons. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. A famous and famously reclusive writer, sort of like J.D. Salinger in that respect, is the central character in the new novel called And Sons, by our next guest, David Gilbert. It's about the writer as author of books and father of sons. Sons who don't feel nearly as warmly toward him as readers do. When And Sons begins, the writer, Andrew Newbold Dyer, is nearing 80. He's still most famous for his first novel, Ampersand, published when he was 27, which was set in a prep school. A review of Anne's Sons in Bloomberg News praised the way Gilbert, quote, weaves together the frayed threads of fame, fatherhood, family, and friendship into a meditation on the blessing and curse of creativity, unquote. And an L.A. Times review described Gilbert as having, quote, a wonderful eye for the madness of families and the madness of writers, unquote. Terry spoke with David Gilbert last Tuesday.
David Gilbert, welcome to Fresh Air. So I want you to start with the very opening of your new novel. And what it actually starts with is a quote from the novel Within the Novel. So if you would read that quote for us.
Yeah, this is from The Spared Man, one of Ann Dyer's probably last books. Sometimes Lewis saw in his sons a mirror that reflected the best of who he was, and he was in awe. Other times he hoped to see nothing of himself and would insist on molding the opposite by force if necessary. Fatherhood is the bending of that alpha and that omega with the wobbly heat of our own fathers mixed in. We love and hate our boys for what they might see.
Well, that's kind of a theme through the book.
Yes,
fathers
for sure.
And sons and fathers and what they see in each other.
Mm-hmm.
So why was this the subject you wanted to build many subplots around?
I have three kids, and my son is 11. He's the oldest. And then my father is almost 80. And I'm 46. So I'm kind of in that position of seeing my son starting to enter into his teen years. So kind of seeing that awkwardness start to develop. And then I'm seeing my father, you know, getting older and a little bit more vulnerable and frailer. So that viewpoint, being in that middle, was really interesting to me. And I wanted to explore that, you know, the sense of being a father and a son in all of its myriad kind of details and ways and emotions.
Do you find yourself changing your thinking about your father as you spend more time as a father yourself?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's the great thing about fatherhood is that not only can you replay your childhood, but you can start to understand your parents so much better. My father was certainly grew up in that generation in which kind of mom did all the work and dad would really only participate once you could do the things that he wanted to do. And I think our generation of fathers have probably gone off in the other direction where we are just there to satisfy every single need of our child, whether it's driving them for 5 hours to play soccer or whatever it is. So definitely my view of not only my parents but of myself has changed from, you know, having this son and my two daughters too.
This reminds me of something that your narrator says about his father. He says that his father, historically speaking, probably missed being sensitive by 8 to 10 years, depending on where you date the new man era.
Mm-hmm. So for sure.
How many years did your father miss the new man era by?
Oh, I think he missed it by more than 8 to 10. He graduated from college in 56, so he was, you know, pretty much in that Eisenhower generation and beforehand. I mean, you know, he kind of was in his 30s during the 60s, but he missed the 60s entirely. Same with my mother. They kind of were in that kind of Nixon silent majority.
So the character at the center of the book, the character that everybody is speculating about, is the writer A.N. Dyer, mm-hmm. who is a reclusive writer who hasn't really written anything new in many years. His novel, Ampersand, is not only a very famous novel, it's a novel that was central to many young people when they were growing up, you mm-hmm. know, when they were coming of age. What made the novel Within the Novel, the Ampersand novel, so famous? What did it mean in the lives of its readers?
I always saw it as kind of the opposite to Catcher in the Rye, whereas Catcher in the Rye was very much about, you know, Holden Caulfield's struggles. Ampersand is kind of about, it's more of a Dostoevsky version of childhood, of adolescence, where it's a lot tougher and it's more Machiavellian and more rough and nasty things happen. So it was kind of, you're not only in the head of Edgar Meade, who's the main character of Ampersand, and you're in that kind of boarding school setting, which is kind of a fun setting for a book. It's always kind of grabs readers. And you see the way that boarding school world can kind of eat people alive. And I think it was more of a look at the dark side of adolescence, whereas Holden Caulfield was kind of a look at the awkward searching side of adolescence. And I think that darkness, like Dostoevsky's books, where you're trying to kind of grapple with the moral center of a character, you know, can definitely grab a hold of a readership.
So people have this idea in their mind of him still as a kind of young writer, because that's how we remember him.
Yeah.
But in reality, he's like, he's old, he has gout, his big toe is killing him, he can't really write anymore.
Big toe, yeah.
Uh-huh. I guess, you know, he has reasons to be reclusive, but what gets him out in public is a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
A funeral of somebody who'd been a close friend in childhood, and he's asked to give a eulogy, and even though he's a writer, he finds the idea of a eulogy terrifying. Why does he find it so terrifying?
Well, it's that, you know, it's like also a toast or a graduation speech, any of those things where you're trying to really speak from the heart and do it in a way that's not sentimental but still sincere. I think those are kind of terrifying moments. So a eulogy is, and also this is from someone who's really not been in public for a long time. So I think it's a mixture of the form, which is, you know, he's not, he likes to be in total control of his books, where a eulogy is a revelation of who you are and your relationship with other people. And he's someone who's had, you know, issues with relationships with other people. So to kind of celebrate that relationship is very difficult for him.
He actually finds a eulogy website.
Yeah.
The person who runs the
website.
One
too.
They're
out
there. I was wondering, really? So
they're absolutely out there. And I paid $19.99 to get like the full eulogy package. You can do it if you are in a bind and
wow.
have a eulogy. You can find self-presented eulogies that you can just fill in the blanks. It's pretty amazing.
Is that the eulogy you write in the book, the one from the website?
I kind of took the flavor of that eulogy and then did it a little bit more.
You got to read some of it. This is
okay.
Just like a generic eulogy.
Yeah.
So just do a few, like your few of your favorite lines.
Okay. This is from Eulogies on Demand. I can't remember what I called the website. Anyway, here it is. They say that at the end of our time on this earth, if you can count a few good friends, you are a fortunate person. I know that I am fortunate because I could always count on blank to be the truest friend I ever did know. And today I am sick with despair, doubly sick because blank is not here to repair me with his, her kind words and loving heart.
Ah, that's moves me to tears.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
No, and I think we've all been at funerals where, you know, the rabbi or priest probably, you know, gave a eulogy that sounded like the rabbi or priest version of that generic eulogy.
Yeah, totally.
While
mm-hmm.
also being at ones that were so moving that you really are moved to tears. But it's just amazing that there are so many websites now to help you be sincere and speak individually from your heart.
Yeah, and this was early on the book, so I found this website probably 7 years ago. So, I mean, it was even back then, you know, 7 years ago doesn't sound like such a long time ago, but in internet years, it's, you know, it's like dog years. It feels like a long time ago. And it was there, you know, probably from the beginning of the internet, they had a eulogy website.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Gilbert. His new novel is called Anne's Sons. You know, I've asked you a little bit about your character's writing. I want to say a couple of things about your own writing, which I really like a lot. And I thought I would just give a couple of very brief examples of sentences that I especially liked. So in writing about the writer and the writer's deceased former best friend, who mm-hmm. weren't very verbal in their friendship, you describe them as these heavily redacted men. And I thought, that's just great to describe people who are always kind of censoring their own emotions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did that come to you? Do you know?
Well, it's just that experience with men of that generation, I think, that they keep so much inside and they let their wives do so much of the emotional heavy lifting, which allows them, for good and mostly bad, just to kind of stay within themselves even more. And I also wanted a character who wanted, especially like Charlie Topping, who is the best friend of A.N. Dyer, I wanted that sense that he wants to say things, but he just doesn't have even the ability to do it. It's just not within his, you know, DNA to be able to express himself that way. Yet there's this yearning to you know, really connect with someone. But they're all kind of, they're redacted. They keep so much to themselves.
Another sentence on the lighter side here. His sleep was sponsored by Vicodin with a two-finger assist from Duers. I like the idea of his sleep being sponsored by Vicodin. again, can you talk at all about how that image came to you?
Well, you know, it took me about 6 years to write this book. So all that stuff comes, you know, it's those brief moments of inspiration, that kind of little shiny bits that stay with all sorts of other bits that kind of fall away. So that's just one of those shiny bits that happened to stay. I don't even remember how I came up with it, except that, you know, I was thinking of these two products, Vicodin and Duers, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, sleep could be sponsored by those two things, and often are.
Yeah.
Not in my case. But
of course not.
In case my mother's listening.
The writer's sons in your novel respond in different ways to being the son of this famous, you know, but reclusive writer. And they respond differently to the sense of privilege that they grew up with. So one of the sons becomes a videographer, and he travels around the world documenting all sorts of human extremes, mostly how people suffer and die, the many different ways, many horrible ways that people suffer and die. I want you to do a reading about that son's work, and this is the narrator describing that son's work. And the narrator doesn't like that work. He doesn't get it. He thinks it's kind of pointless. There's no story. There's no explanation. It's just documenting horrible things. And the narrator thinks that this art is just kind of playing into our voyeuristic inhumanity. So I'm going to ask you to read more about his response.
Sure. Despite the college-worn earnestness, I understood the motivation, the almost incandescent urge for the dreadful thing. When you are a decent person and you have grown up safe and comfortable with parents who themselves have grown up safe and comfortable in New York, no less, the Upper East Side of New York, no less, you often find yourself admiring the poor and desperate around you as if they are somehow more honest, more legitimate than your tribe, Buddhist to your capitalist. And you want to prove yourself conscious with a capital C by dipping into that hardship lower, that degradation lower, that self-abasement. There is liberal guilt and there is liberal sin, where you go slumming, the most cheerful of vagrants. I know I was guilty of this. The stories I wrote in my creative writing classes always gravitated toward seedy locales, dive bars, and trailer parks, with low-down folk in the dirtiest of circumstances. Ugliness seemed to signify emotional authenticity. Half of my characters had problems with heroin, and I had never seen heroin before, let alone had a problem with it. But please, give me a hit of tragedy so I might swim in more human waters. This desire thankfully passed after graduation, when genuineness was no longer an issue for debate. The concrete had hardened. But Jamie, he became worse, turning into a tourist with forensic intent. He started to travel to ridiculously rough places and to videotape whatever he came across. The siege of Sarajevo, the red light district of Mumbai, the civil wars in Algeria and Sri Lanka and Sierra Leone, the everything in Palestine, the whatever you've got of human misery. Why'd he do this? Maybe he was rebelling against his father. This, right here, this is the real world, Dad. This is true tragedy.
So did you ever go through a period like that in your own art of thinking that the world you lived in was inauthentic and you had to, like, immerse yourself into tragedy and ugliness?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, the short stories I wrote in college and the early ones in my MFA program were all about, you know, people who were more on the fringe and kind of living desperate lives. And that seemed, you know, I was also a big Raymond Carver fan, and Dennis Johnson was a huge influence on all of us in MFA programs everywhere in the early 90s. So we're all trying to kind of ape that world, and that seemed so much more legitimate than my upbringing. So it took me a while to see that their story is everywhere, no matter, you know, where you were raised, that we're all basically living, you know, the same tale. And I just took fathers and sons as that tale.
Since the novel is so much about, you know, fathers and sons and fathers, in an interview you said raising children is an act of love as well as an act of fiction in which the characters slowly free themselves from the supposed author. Do you see an analogy there between, you know, a father and son and an author and his characters?
Yeah, I mean, I think the author is always in pretty, you know, some writers say that, you know, their characters will just do something that will surprise them, or they'll lose control of their characters. I've always felt pretty in control of my characters. I've never had that experience where it's just like, oh my God, my character is now, you know, kiteboarding. I didn't expect that. But with children, you're kind of like, I'm going to raise, you know, I'm going to have a kid who loves to go to museums and is going to be a great reader and is going to do this and that. And then suddenly you're presented with this, you know, boy or girl who have a different agenda and are they're not the fiction that you thought you were making. They're actually their own little person. And you have to give up on these ideas of them representing a piece of you. They are themselves. And that's always the tricky part. And the kind of, you know, that's where it happens when they're 8, 9, 10 years old. And you're like, okay, this is their own person here. And I just need to, I'm along for the ride.
Well, David Gilbert, I wish you much success with the novel. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
David Gilbert spoke with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Gilbert's new novel is called And Sons. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly Seaver-Nesper is our associate producer for online media. Didn't I say? What did I say? Okay. Molly Seaver-Nesper is our assistant Molly Seaver-Nesper is our assistant. I know. Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, thanks, Molly, for joining our staff. Okay. Molly Seaver-Nesper is our assistant producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.